Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, it's Klaatu, and this is the continuation of the Egyptian pantheon as proscribed in the Dungeons & Dragons Player Handbook 5th edition. In the previous episode, we covered a little bit about the Egyptian mythology in general, the pantheon just in general, and we discussed how it was a little bit chaotic and overlapped with a lot of itself because it grew rather organically across a pretty wide geographic region and then sort of collided at various times over the course of hundreds of years, really. And in this episode, and then we spoke about the lawful good, the lawful neutral, and the lawful evil. So in this episode, we're going to finish that up with the neutral gods and the chaotic gods. So here we go. So the first one that we'll start with is the neutral good god named Hathor, or Hathor. Let's go with Hathor. Hathor is the goddess of love, music, and motherhood. She is neutral good. Her suggested domains are life and light, and her symbol is a horned cow's head with a lunar disc on it. So Hathor is the embodiment of joy, feminine love, and motherhood. She's the goddess of music, dance, of foreign lands, and fertility. She was believed to assist women in childbirth and to protect them during that process, and there are rituals somewhere that have been written down from inscriptions in Egypt on how to bless and sanctify and also just make hygienic the place where you're going to give birth, which is, you know, obviously important for both the child and the mother. And then she's also believed to have been the patron goddess of miners. I don't mean children, I mean miners, people who work in mines, which is interesting and doesn't really fit in with anything else. But it does make her rather a good goddess for, again, the obvious dwarves, or maybe even gnomes, you know. It kind of depends on how you play your gnomes. For her ritual, she has a very specific, a cleric might, to honor her, there is a very specific amulet. It is called a Menat amulet, M-E-N-A-T, and you can look that up online and see what it is, but it's a ceremonial kind of necklace. It's decorated with beads usually, and it is structured. It's a rather large, I mean, it's an amulet, so it's not, you know, it's not like a charm necklace. It's an amulet, so it's a very large kind of thing that's supposed to, I think, shield you from evil, sort of apotropic magic, sort of deflection type stuff. That's pretty much it for Hathor. The fact that her symbol is a cow's head with a lunar disc is, from what I understand, it's an amalgamation of a couple of different things, actually. First of all, there's great reverence for cows, for cattle, in ancient Egypt, because they're really useful animals for lots of different things. Same things that we use them for now, I guess, but also sort of horsepower, except it would be cow power. And the lunar disc, if I'm recalling correctly, is actually something that got imported later along with the Greeks, because a lot of when the Greeks started to move in and really intermingle with the Egyptians, there were a lot of ideas that they brought from their own religion and kind of started equating a bunch of Egyptian gods with theirs, and so certain symbology started to bleed over into weird places. And I'm not too interested in that, so I'm going to just kind of skip merrily over it. But Hathor, I mean, I feel like I've probably emphasized possibly too much the motherhood angle. She's also a goddess of love and music and celebration, so she would be a great goddess for bards and people who like to celebrate. Okay, so she's neutral good, and she is neutral good because she brings all of these things to anyone, regardless of their station. Next on the table for neutral good is Imhotep. Now, Imhotep is a god, is the god, according to the player's handbook, god of crafts and medicine, neutral good, domain knowledge, and the symbol, his symbol is a step pyramid. So Imhotep, historically, was kind of unique within the Egyptian pantheon, as far as I know, and it kind of harkens back to some of the gods of Porphyra for me, is that he actually started out as a mortal. He was a chancellor or an officer of some sort under a pharaoh named Djoser, or Djoser. I'm not really sure how to say it. Djoser. And he wasn't regarded as a god, and certainly, I mean, he wasn't even a pharaoh, so in life he didn't walk around and have people calling him a god or even godlike. But after his death, he became deified one way or another. He is called the one who comes in peace. He is widely known and respected for his healing powers. He is considered to be he's neutral good, and he is considered to be he's a very good god. He will heal anything, no matter what their position in life or what their feelings are. He is a healer. He's sometimes called the son of Ptah, although I'm not really sure where that comes from. I feel like that's probably another one of those collisions, because he was immortal, so he actually had a mother. And in some, I guess at some point maybe his mother was regarded as godly herself, but later legend started calling him the son of Ptah. So his mother, is also a goddess called Sekhmet, who is the consort of Ptah. Now, Sekhmet is a really, really powerful goddess, actually. She's not in the table on the handbook, in the player's handbook pantheon, so I don't really get to talk about her all that much. But luckily, she got combined with another goddess later on, so she kind of gets... She gets some screen time, she just doesn't, not as herself. Either way, as herself, she can be considered the mother of Imhotep, and she is a powerful, powerful god, or goddess. She was originally called the Eye of Ra, and Ra basically sent his eye, E-Y-E, down to Earth to bring justice. And so Sekhmet is this justice bringer of violence and military and war. She's a super powerful goddess and is basically an extension of Ra, or part of Ra, but obviously her own thing as well. Really cool goddess. I like her a lot. And in this pantheon, she's just basically mom. So Imhotep is considered, because he's a healer and a neutral healer, he's considered the god of medicine. He's also a magic user and a fighter. If required, he will protect what he loves, but more often than not, he's considered a god of medicine. He's a god for physicians and so on. Now, in real life, like historically, the figure who was deified, as far as anyone knows, was not a physician and not a healer, but he was a man of peace, and people liked him, and so he's now a god of healing, a god of medicine, and sometimes a god of magic when he needs to use magic for something. So again, his domain given in the handbook is knowledge, and I would probably, if I was playing him in 3.5, of course, I would add the healing domain to his list of things that he does. The healing domain grants powers like your touch staves off pain and death, and your healing magic is particularly vital and potent. Yeah, kind of an obvious one, I think. Okay, so next on our list, we've got yet another neutral, I think, yeah, another neutral good god. I don't know, they kind of went crazy with the neutral goods on this one, but the next one is Isis, and Isis is the goddess of fertility and magic. She's listed as neutral good. Her suggested domains are knowledge and life, and her symbols are the Ankh, you know the Ankh, and the star. And frankly, Isis is such a huge god, and she just kept getting huger. I could probably talk about her for an entire episode. She's super important. She's this goddess who just her impact on the religion and on honestly a lot, like even pop culture and stuff, can't be understated. She's huge. And I mean, it fits, because I mean, surely we've all heard of Isis. I mean, everyone knows the goddess of the goddess Isis. Everyone knows that name. So and everyone knew that name before some group took that name. So Isis, really, really important goddess. Super influential. She was one of the originals. So the originals are it's called the Ennead, Ennead. The Ennead of Heliopolis was it was like this group of, I think, nine gods. And it was kind of the inner circle of the pantheon, really. And it included big names like Ra and Seth and, I want to say Osiris, but that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But yeah, so it was the inner circle of the pantheons, and it was kind of an early inner circle before a lot of the combining and compositing started happening. So she's got siblings, or whatever. Again, in the Egyptian pantheon, or in the Egyptian mythology, it's really difficult to separate out what siblings are versus what consorts are. It gets very confusing, and that's not to say that they can't be the same thing in mythology. They frequently are, but it's not really clear, so it's difficult to say one way or the other. So she has siblings, Osiris, Seth, and Nephthys, and you'll recall that's also that sort of group of dysfunctional. This whole group is dysfunctional. It's Isis and Osiris are together, Seth and Nephthys are together, but Osiris and Nephthys cheated, but Isis was okay with it, Seth was not. So Isis and Nephthys are okay with each other, Nephthys and Osiris are definitely okay with each other, Isis and Osiris are okay with each other, and Seth is just kind of the odd man out, pretty angry at Osiris, and eventually kills him. You know that if you heard the previous episode. So they're the last generation of the Ennead, which kind of descended from Geb and Nut, who are earth and sky, respectively. So she's one of the originals, is what I'm trying to say. And she's one of the really major players in one of the most major stories within the surviving stories, you know, the things that we think of when we think of Egyptian mythology. The Osiris versus Seth battle is one of the big events, and Isis is right in there among that. Now, she becomes even more important when she revives Osiris after he's chopped up into little itty-bitty pieces by Seth. She reassembles him, has sex with him, in some form, and there are a couple of different ways that might have happened, depending on what story you're reading, and becomes pregnant with Horus, and then, of course, eventually gives birth to Horus. And Horus is important for a reason that you will find out later in this episode. She also supposedly has seven sort of scorpion deities that travel around with her to guard her. So she's got sort of a posse, I guess, or an entourage. And you gotta admit, seven minor scorpion demons traveling around with you is pretty legitimate. That's pretty cool. I would, I, I I would worship a goddess with seven scorpion deities that followed her around. That's cool to me. She also supposedly, and this is not confirmed by her, but supposedly she created a snake at one point to bite Ra, or in this pantheon specifically, Ra-Harakhti. So she created this snake, and the snake bites Ra-Harakhti, and then she comes up afterwards and says, "Hey, Ra-Harakhti, I will heal you if you tell me your secret name." Now that's huge in Egypt culture, because, or at least in Egyptian mythology. I don't know if it was actually that huge in real life historically, but in the mythology, that's huge. You can't know someone's secret name, because knowing that name gives you power over them. We've all kind of heard that sort of thing, but that's how Egyptians regarded art and writing and all that sort of thing. Like, if you write it down, then it has permanence and it has power. Or if you make a representation of it, it has permanence and it has power. So, and you're giving it strength. So giving out a secret name, especially for a god like Ra or Ra-Harakhti, big deal. But in the end, he's got no choice, and so he does. He tells her his secret name, and so she gains power over basically everything, because Ra-Harakhti created everything. So it's a big deal. She gets a lot of power from that. And in fact, it is said that she has power over fate itself, which in the Egyptian mythology, in the Egyptian pantheon, that's a big deal, because the Egyptian gods didn't really necessarily, we think of, certainly within the Christian religion, the big god is kind of Yahweh or whatever, is kind of considered omniscient, knows everything past, knows everything present, knows everything future. In the Egyptian mythology, they don't really, that's not how it is. You might have a lot of knowledge, you might be really smart, you might be really old, but you don't necessarily know how things are going to turn out next week, next year, in the future. Isis supposedly has power over fate itself. Now, I'm not really sure whether she has power, like, on a whim, she can just change the course of destiny, or if she just has influence over it, but she's supposed to be super powerful, and a lot of that stems from this trick that she played on Ra-Harakhti. Or, I don't know if he was Ra-Harakhti at the time, but again, player handbook version Ra-Harakhti. She is also known at some point, she kind of became the goddess of the sky, which is a little bit weird, because there's already a goddess of the sky called Nut, and she was the parent of Ptah, of Osiris. So it's a little bit strange, and Isis is the consort of Osiris. So yeah, it starts to get very confused, but as I've said several times before, the Egyptian mythology tends to do that, so it's okay. And the reason that she became sort of associated with the sky, if I recall correctly, was, again, the Greeks came in and started heaping a bunch of more stuff onto Isis because she kind of fit, and they sort of saw her as a pretty good stand-in for, you know, some other goddess, and so they kind of started assigning her a bunch of extra things. Or maybe the Egyptians did, based on what the Greeks were talking about and on their god. I wasn't there. I don't really know how it went down. But she kind of became composited or associated with Sopdet, a goddess that is represented by the star Sirius. So she became sort of a celestial god, sky and stars and stuff, in addition to everything else that she already was. And she was a lot of things. Isis is really, really well, you know, she was worshipped in a big way. She had a lot of influence, and she was actually pretty decent. I mean, once again, like the Greek pantheon, you can usually find a lot to dislike about a lot of the major gods, but Isis is actually pretty cool. She's given credit for a lot of creativity and a lot of life-affirming kinds of stuff, you know, motherhood and fertility and life in general, just kind of celebration of life, and the end eternal, the ongoingness of life. And of course, because she's an Egyptian goddess, she also hangs out in the underworld. She became one of the goddesses. I mean, there must be a competition. You must get down to the underworld, and there's like a bunch of boats to cross the river, whatever it is, and like everyone's trying to flag you down. Here, ride in my boat. I'll escort your soul, because I mean, it's like a taxi, a bunch of taxis or something. Because I'm telling you, all the gods and goddesses are given credit for escorting souls through the underworld, and Isis is given that as well. I don't think that I would necessarily accentuate that myself, because it's a pretty crowded space. So those are all the neutral good gods, all three of them, and that leads us to true neutral, neutral neutral, the neutral neutral god of the player handbook version of the Egyptian pantheon is Thoth. Thoth is the god of knowledge and wisdom. Alignment is neutral. Suggested domain, knowledge. And symbol is the ibis, or the ibis. Or the baboon, actually. But in the player handbook, it's the ibis. Never really known what an ibis, or I'm not even sure if I'm saying it correctly, really. Ibis? Ibis? I never really knew what they were, but I looked them up, and yeah, they're birds that sort of wade around in on the riverbanks. But they're notable for their bills, which curve sharply downward, and that's, you've probably, like, Anubis being the god that you've definitely seen, I think Thoth is a close second. I feel like I've seen Thoth a lot in artwork. So he's a man, and he has the head of either an ibis or a baboon. He's known for being the arbiter of godly disputes. So when the gods do fight, Thoth is there to step in and manage things, and hopefully find a resolution. He is known for the arts of magic, for devising a system of writing, for development of science. As extensions of those departments, he's often credited with making all the calculations that were required when the heavens and the stars and the heavenly bodies were put into place. He's an important god because he's the science god. He's the science/alchemist god. He came up with all of this fancy, you know, math and science and astronomy and astrology and geometry, botany, just all of that stuff. He's the god from whom all of those things flow. Now, he is married, or his consort, as they say, is Maat. And I haven't talked about Maat yet, and it's kind of crazy that I haven't. But Maat is, it's M-A-A-T, or possibly M-A-apostrophe-A-T. It kind of depends on how you're transliterating it. But it's this concept, actually. And Maat is making things right, or keeping things right, doing the right thing, Maat. And it's actually the principle of, it's the guiding principle for all of the gods within the pantheon. They are either for Maat or they are against Maat, but that's the thing that the godhood revolves around, is Maat. And so Maat is considered the consort of Thoth, and it's almost an ancient Egyptian version of, I guess, our classic reason versus emotion duality. There's Maat, and then there's all this science-y stuff. So it's almost like there's spirituality, and then there's the forces of the universe. So the existence of things and the thing that keeps them going. This reminds me in a way of the Pagana pantheon, which I covered in episode something or another, where there was this god called Rune, R-O-O-N, and Rune said, "There are gods of moving and gods of standing still, but I am the god of going." I kind of feel like Thoth represents a god of going. That said, Thoth is really just the god of the sciences. He is the god of learning and education, and I guess of knowledge, although we've got a lot of gods in the domain of knowledge on this table, but that's what he is. He's the god of all of this higher knowledge, and I think he would be a brilliant god, I would say, for a wizard and that sort of intelligence-based character. He also sometimes gets associated with the moon, which is as good a symbol as any, and later on, I think, in his mythos, he got associated with being the judge of the dead. But I feel like Anubis has that pretty well taken care of, and I would probably not assign that to Thoth personally, even though historically that was something that he took over at some point. So that's the neutral god. There's only one neutral god on the list to choose from, so that's him right there. I mean, true neutral. Okay, so now let's go to the singular neutral evil god on the list, which is Apep. He's the god of evil, fire, and serpents. He is neutral evil. His suggested domain is trickery, and his symbol is a flaming snake. Apep is really the anti-Maat. He's really pretty solidly invested in the evil stuff, and he doesn't really have any goal. He is just evil. So there's this center, this point of reference that the gods must or that the gods have, and it is called, as I've just said, Maat, and Apep disregards Maat. He goes against Maat. That is his express and stated goal. So I would say that you could probably add to his trickery domain if you're playing him in 3.5 Pathfinder. You could probably add to his domains things like destruction, things like death. Maybe not death, actually. More like destruction, evil. That's the one I was thinking of. Evil. And maybe madness, maybe not. You maybe have to think about that one. But he is quite evil, and he's called the serpent from the Nile, or the evil lizard. He was born after Ra, so he's born from something pretty good after Ra, and apparently he kind of sprang or formed from Ra's discarded umbilical cord. I don't really know how that happens, but it does. It did, and that was how Apep rose. You know, came into being was this discarded umbilical cord of Ra. But he's totally evil. He's like the evil version of Ra, I guess. Prayers against Apep are very common. So people who worship Apep, I gather, almost maybe there's a cult out there that's really into evil and wants to kind of be self-destructive and go down this evil path, but a lot of people are praying sort of against Apep, to ward him away. So one of the rituals against Apep would be you make a model of Apep, which again, in the ancient Egyptian culture, that's a big deal. If you make a model of something, you're sort of bringing permanence to it. So you would make a model of Apep. I mean, you'd probably have good models around to ward away Apep's model, but you'd make a model of Apep, maybe as a serpent or something, and then you would burn that model while reciting a spell to make him weak. In other words, people don't like Apep. People like to have Apep go away. People don't want Apep around. And he's neutral evil, so he doesn't really care who you are or what you're all about. He's going to try to bring destruction and evil into your area, and hopefully you can ward that away. So that's Apep, neutral evil. Next up is chaotic. Let's go with chaotic good. So the chaotic good goddess that we have on this list is called Bast, B-A-S-T. And you might also encounter Bast in the real world as Bastet. She is the goddess of cats and the goddess of vengeance. She's chaotic good. Her suggested domain is war, and her symbol is the cat. So Bast or Bastet, depends on what time frame you're reading stuff on and how they've transliterated it and so on. But she's actually sort of a composite of Bast and Sekhmet, who is the Eye of Ra. So at some point, Ra Horakhti took his eye and sent it to Earth so that justice could be served on some region. And this, the Eye of Ra, was Sekhmet. And Sekhmet is this kind of war priestess, war goddess, super powerful, vengeful, violent goddess. And so Bast became sort of part Bast and part Sekhmet in local legend. She started out, as many of these gods did, as kind of a local deity, and she was born of a city called Bubastis, which apparently even shows up it's a pretty common city it was a pretty big city at the time. You can read about it in lots of different sources. Of course, because of languages and stuff, it has different names. But it was a big, major city, and Bast was pretty popular there. And she was always portrayed as a fierce lioness. And then later, as she grew into sort of a cross between Bast and Sekhmet, she became either a fierce lioness or a cat warrior, a woman with a cat head, kind of like a tabaxi, goddess of the sun. And then later, somehow she became associated with the moon because the Greeks came in and started associating her with Artemis. So she kind of also became a moon goddess. But you could choose either, or you could say she's both a sun and a moon goddess. Point being that she's a fierce warrior. And she was... The Egyptians, from what people write, kind of admired lions as hunters because they hunt so well. They hunt as packs, in groups, I guess, apparently, and they stalk their prey, and, I mean, you know how cats are. I mean, assuming that lions are exactly the same as domestic house cats, which I can only assume they are, they will, you know, sort of get down on the ground and stalk their prey and then toy with it before finally ripping its head off, that sort of thing. And that's Bast. That's what she would do. She got associated at some point with perfume as well. So there would be jars of perfume, and they would frequently adorn those jars with images of Bast for whatever reason. So rituals, a cleric worshipping Bast might perform rituals with, you know, specifically with perfumes and whatever it's called when you do things with scents, with smells, you know, with not necessarily incense, but perfume and the different responses that smells evoke. She also gets a whole festival to herself. There's a day every year on the day of her festival. There's a whole town. I think this was recorded by a Greek historian, I think Herodotus. There was a whole town that attracted something like 700,000 visitors, men, women. They arrive in crowded ships, and the women all dance and sing and play music, and then everyone goes to a temple or whatever, and they drink a bunch of wine, and that's the festival of Bastet or Bast. So if you're looking for a campaign or a situation that involves a big citywide party, that would be one of them that you could drop your players in the middle of this festival day of Bast. Next chaotic good goddess on the list is Nephthys. So Nephthys you've already heard about, technically, if you listened to the previous episode. She's the goddess of death and grief. Her suggested domain is death. And her symbol is horns around a lunar disc. And when I'm describing these symbols, the solar discs and the lunar discs, you may have seen drawings of Egyptian characters with just big circles on their head. That's what I'm talking about. Those are the discs. Okay, so Nephthys is the sister, maybe, of Isis, and she is the consort of Seth, who we'll get to very soon. She cheated on Seth with Osiris, if you can call it cheated. She had sex with Osiris in some versions of the mythology. Seth didn't like that. Isis was okay with it. Nephthys was okay with it. Osiris was okay with it. It was really only Seth that was bugged by it. So I don't know if we can call it cheating. But anyway, whatever your morals are in that regard, that's what happened. Now, after Seth killed and chopped into pieces Osiris, Nephthys actually went to help Isis find Osiris's body, the various pieces of it, and then reassemble them. So she really was totally okay with all of this stuff. She didn't apparently, like, none of this somehow convinced her that Seth was not good enough to stay with, for instance. So, as far as I know, she and Seth didn't, you know, part ways after he killed and chopped her lover. She just went and helped put him back together again. That's what gods do. So she's solidly within the death domain. She's a representation of mourning, of the funerary process. Rituals to her might historically have been to perform plays honoring the bond that Isis and Nephthys share, and whether they're sisters literally or just sisters, you know, figuratively, kind of like, oh, we're sisters. It doesn't really matter, I don't think. The point is that they were very close, and they stuck together through thick and thin. She's also the goddess of temples, of holy places, of ships, of structures. Really, she's called the lady of the house, or the house goddess, and that it's not really just a house. It's more like any structure. At least that's what I've been led to understand from my reading. So she's a goddess of places, of structures. She's also the goddess of birds. Actually, a very specific regional bird, but since I don't really know what that bird is, I can't really picture it, don't really have any feelings about it, I think I would probably have Nephthys be the goddess of whatever cool bird that I wanted to incorporate into my campaign or my story or whatever. So she might be the goddess of ravens, or of crows, or of condors, or of hawks, or of owls, any of those good ones. That's Nephthys. She is chaotic good, and yet her domain is death. It's kind of beautiful. There's a lot of beauty in a lot of these little surprises. Next up is Bes, the god of luck and music. He is chaotic neutral. His domain is trickery. His symbol is the image of the misshapen deity. And that's what Bes is, or Bestet, depends on, again, what you're reading. But Bes is a protector of homes and family life. So he's associated with celebrations, with music, sex, dance, childbirth, and things like that, things that happen in daily life. Bes was pretty popular. People would get, as part of the ritual for worshipping Bes, people would get tattoos of Bes. Now, the reason that Bes's symbol is a misshapen deity is because Bes is actually kind of deformed. He's kind of ugly, not super attractive, but he's a partier, and people really, really like him. He celebrates things. he's neutral. He doesn't really care so much about who you are or what you do. He just wants to have a good time, but a safe time as well. Safety first. He protects the domicile. In my mind, he's a little bit like, for instance, Bacchus or that kind of god, like a party god. And yet, at the same time, he's so responsible. He's a protector, and he gives blessings for the things that happen in the home. So it's an interesting mix, and one that I really kind of like, because it makes home sound like a lot of fun. So that's Bess, chaotic neutral. And I think the next and possibly final god is chaotic evil, Seth, the god of darkness and desert storms. His domains are death, tempest, and trickery, and his symbol are coiled cobras. So Seth is the god, essentially the god of chaos, and I say essentially because he's not exactly a god of chaos, but that's what he's most famous for. He's the god of chaos, of desert, of storms, of foreigners, so basically a lot of change, anything that's not the same, that's not stable. His siblings slash family slash whatever is Osiris, Isis, and Nephthys. He married Nephthys, or whatever it is that we're calling the union of two gods in this mythology. He is the father of Anubis. Anubis, of course, being the, especially in this pantheon, in the player handbook version, kind of the main guy for the underworld, depending on how you want to handle the whole Osiris and Anubis both being gods of underworld thing, and Isis, and probably some others. So he has the head of some animal, Seth does, and no one knows what that animal is. It is not a human head, we know that. Some people say that it's sort of an aardvark, some people say it's something else. No one's really sure, so they just call it the Seth animal. He killed Osiris. I've covered that in both episodes now, so I'm not going to recover that now. And then the son of Isis and Osiris, the posthumous son of Osiris, Horus, sought revenge upon Seth. Traditionally, there's a lot of confusion about how their fights actually occurred. There's a lot of different versions of this. Some of them are kind of almost pleasant Olympian style feats of physical prowess, and other times they're super disturbing sexual abuse kind of combat. Really, really sort of creepy stuff. So it just kind of depends on who you go with in terms of how disturbing you want this to have been. But in the end, Horus and Seth both managed to mangle each other horribly, body parts everywhere, all kinds of wounds. In some versions, Isis gets in on the battle, and she accidentally, I think, kills Horus. And so in despair, she cuts off her own head. And then Thoth has to come in and put a cow head back on her body so that she's not dead. It gets really colorful depending on how far you go down the different paths of myth. In the end, almost as far as I can tell, universally, everyone's restored to full health. Now, whether they have their same head on their same body or whatever, I wouldn't swear to that, but almost regardless of any of whoever you're listening to tell the story, it seems that in the end, it's kind of like no harm, no foul. Seth is still around, Horus is still around, Isis is still around. Osiris generally is considered to have just kind of gone off to the ether, but he's a god, so it's not that big of a change. And Nephthys is still Nephthys. So, yeah, there's a big battle. Horus, you know, trains all of his life to take revenge on Seth, takes revenge, and then everything's back to normal. One of those kind of typical climaxes of mythology, I think, where a bunch of epic stuff is going to happen, but in the end, it doesn't really make that much of a difference. Now, Seth himself, the god, as I say, is a god of chaos and change and instability. So, and certainly in this pantheon, he is classified as chaotic evil. So he needs to be chaotic. He needs to be evil. He needs to be really sort of despicable. And interestingly, in the Egyptian pantheon, that doesn't actually exist all that much. I mean, it might somewhere, but I haven't been able to find it, which was the same problem I'd had, if you recall, from my Pagana episode. The Pagana episodes, I was not necessarily able to find a properly chaotic evil god, and kind of had to borrow from Lovecraft. And honestly, if you go by the mythology, Seth isn't really all that chaotic evil. He certainly has his complaints about some things, but he does some pretty crazy stuff. I mean, he kills Osiris and chops his body up. I guess you could classify that as chaotic evil. But in terms of kind of his global world view, that's not how he acts, really. He's actually a pretty decent fellow to his worshippers. He's not, you know, he doesn't, like, demand people come to him and sacrifice humans to him, or sacrifice themselves, or self-destructive things. He's not really like that in any of the incarnations that I've been able to find. Now, maybe I'm just not digging deep enough. Like I said in the previous episode, I'm not a historian or an Egyptologist or anything like that, so maybe I'm just not reading enough, but from what I can tell, he actually had a lot of... I mean, well, there was one pharaoh, for instance, who really, really liked Seth to the point that he kind of outlawed much of the pantheon if it wasn't Seth, and Seth was the reigning god of some iteration of Egypt for some time. People didn't like it and rebelled eventually, but you know, he was kind of mainstream. So whether or not he fits the bill as a really demonic, evil god, I'm not convinced, and I think you would probably have to add some color to Seth's backstory to make him really malevolent and really despicable and scary, which you can do easily. You can totally do that, but it's not written into his historical accounts of what Seth was. Now, admittedly, Seth became worse as the years went on. Yeah, I mean, not Seth, but the interpretation of Seth. The people kind of added to his legend, such that he kind of got worse and worse and worse, and sort of more evil and more dangerous as, you know, as the centuries went by. Just because he started getting a reputation of not being a good god, so they really kind of started to make him more evil. But I'm still myself, I don't have a juicy story for you of how he wants, you know, societies to crumble and things like that. It's just not really there. So you might have to make Seth a little bit more chaotic, a little bit more evil on the global grand scale, grand scheme of things, on a big scale, universal scale, because that's what you want out of a chaotic god. You want that chaotic god to want destruction. You want reality should be threatened by a chaotic evil god. At least that's how I feel about it. Either way, that's the end of the Egyptian deities table in the 5th edition Player's Handbook on page 299. So if you want to use that pantheon, now you have a little backstory on each of those gods, and you kind of have a feel for what they were all about. I hope this has been helpful. I hope I have not completely done injustice to the ancient Egyptian mythology. I know that I'm really kind of flying off of having read a couple of books as a kid and a couple of books as an adult by it, so I know I'm not doing it justice, but I hope that it has at least been entertaining, somewhat informative, and certainly inspiring. Thanks for listening. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.